I was an idiot. I trusted Joe Manchin. We'll discuss this and much more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the sage of authenticity woods, Jim Garrity, Alexander Zan DeSanctis, and Dan Baseball Crank McLaughlin. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, Tommy John, and the Acton Unwind podcast. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So before I do anything else, let's hear a sponsored message from NetChoice. New polling shows 65% of Americans blame Biden and the Democrats for rising inflation. If they stand on a united platform to fight inflation, Republicans will likely do well in this year's midterm elections. But some lawmakers, like Representative Ken Buck, are degrading that strategy by backing proposals which 85% of Americans believe will make inflation worse. The last thing Republicans should be doing ahead of the midterms is supporting progressive pet projects. Only 1% of voters say they want Congress to focus on tech regulation, while 60% say they want lawmakers to focus on inflation. To win in November, Republicans should listen to the people and fight back against inflationary regulations pushed by progressives. Join us in urging lawmakers to oppose Democratic pet projects like S-2992, and tell Congress to focus on the issues that matter to you. Learn more about this fight and send a letter to your representatives at netchoice.org/2992. That's netchoice.org/2992. This message brought to you, of course, by NetChoice. So, Jim, you discussed this a little bit on Friday when you were manfully attempting to guest host in my absence the shocker Joe Manchin, Chuck Schumer deal. A lot of us assumed Build Back Better in every single form iteration was dead, but they pulled this rabbit out of a hat. It was a lot of discussion about it on the Sunday shows. Still a lot of argument going on about it. I mean, something that I'm struck by is just the sheer incoherence of this deal. One, the ridiculous deceptive labeling, calling it the Inflation Reduction Act when it has nothing to do with inflation, when you have this independent Penn Wharton budget model showing it'll slightly, you know, with an emphasis on slightly, we're not talking about big numbers here, slightly increase inflation until 2024, and then very slightly decrease inflation afterwards. One of the big selling points, according to Manchin, is, wow, look at this, $300 billion of deficit reduction to counter inflation. Of course, that's over 10 years. We can all hope and pray that actually we're not going to have a major inflation problem for the next decade. And then just Manchin, a week or so ago, joined all the Democrats and a bunch of Republicans voting for this CHIPS Act that spent $280 billion that wasn't paid for. So even before the Schumer Manchin bill passes, they've already spent what supposedly the deficit reduction is. And then he constantly maintains that there's no tax increase in this bill, when obviously there's a tax increase. A corporate minimum tax of 15% is a tax increase. He claims he's just it's just closing loopholes. What do you make of this a couple mornings after in the cold light of day?
Well, Rich, a long list of questions remain, most notably, what do you mean attempt to guest host? I guest hosted. There were witnesses. Look, I think we now realize this entire time, Joe Manchin had a clear problem with Build Back Better. And that problem was the title. If you call it the Inflation Reduction Act, he's fine with it. Ah, it's good stuff. It's great. You know, yeah. You know. Look, I think we now know the price to get Manchin to flip. All eyes are on Kyrsten Sinema. And look, I don't want to get people's hopes up too high. But I do think it's intriguing that here we are on August 2nd, and she has not signed on. Each day that Kyrsten Sinema does not sign on to this deal is one more signifier that she's not going to be an easy get for Schumer and the rest of the Democrats. You would hate to see her effectively rewarding a Democratic Party and a progressive activist class that was chasing her into a bathroom and basically acting like unhinged maniacs. And you'd like to see her teaching a good lesson to the rest of the party that, you know, if you want to bring her over, if you want to win over your dissidents, if you want to have people who are in purple or reddish leaning states to come over to you, then you're going to probably going to have to give ground on policy. I think she will eventually come around. I think she's probably going to find one or two fig leaves to qualify as victories. Maybe she'll, you know, tweak down the tax rates a bit or something like that. It is interesting. I do think you're starting to see Democrats get really nervous about the fact that she hasn't immediately jumped on, and Schumer and Manchin look like absolute idiots for not reading her in, or not, at least not keeping her in the loop on the state of their negotiations. Apparently she was blindsided by this. This is just basic management of your caucus. And the good news for Republicans is that Schumer's been terrible at this. So, I mean, I'm not enormously optimistic, but I do think it's intriguing that she did not look at this and say, oh yes, this is good, I'm on board.
Yeah, so Zan, I at the outset of this long process where Manchin, you know, neither Sinema or Manchin was on board, but all the focus mostly was not, most of the focus was on Manchin. I was always, Manchin, you can't trust him. You know, he wants to cut the deal at the end of the day. He's a Democrat. He doesn't mind spending. But then slowly over time, I began to believe. I began to believe in Joe Manchin. I just thought he was solid and we could lock it away. Turned out to be completely wrong. And what really annoys me, and we saw this past weekend when Manchin went on five Sunday shows, is he goes out of his way to preserve part of Biden's agenda. And then the same breath is like, I don't know whether I'm going to support Joe Biden. You know, I don't know whether Democrats deserve to take the majority. And to me, it just seems so transparently cynical and kind of boob bait for Bubba, for those West Virginia voters who went for Trump with 40 points or whatever it was, to say, you know, I'm still, it's okay. I'm still the same old Joe. Don't worry about me.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make of him. I think he has flip-flop enough times in my memory on things. And, you know, even on the same decision has gone back and forth a few times. My main thought about this is, you know, I have no confidence he's actually going to stick with saying he's going to support it. I mean, I could very easily see him coming out later and saying, actually, sorry, you know, I changed my mind. Like, I would not be at all surprised to see that. And so I'm just kind of at the point with him where I never assume that Manchin's going to do one thing or another until he's actually done it and the vote is cast and it's over, because he just changes his mind so much. And I can't really think, there are a lot of factors at play, one of which is he's not particularly wedded to progressivism. I don't think that he, you know, on principle is where the Democratic Party is moving. I think he actually didn't like a lot of what was in Build Back Better. But I think at the same time, he's not a Republican. He's not a conservative. He doesn't mind spending, and people in his state don't mind spending. And so I think he's really just kind of sticking his finger up into the political winds and seeing where they blow. And they happen to change quite a bit. And so he does as well. So I don't know what that means for this bill in particular, but I think it's foolish for him to think that people in his state aren't going to notice what's actually in it. And that it is, as Jim points out, quite similar to what he said he couldn't support before.
Yeah. All that said, you know, he does get credit for, he killed off a lot of spending. So we're in his debt for that. And he's also not the most cogent, you know, policy guy. Some of these op-eds he wrote against Build Back Better, I appreciated the spirit of them, but they didn't make a huge amount of sense. And so it kind of is natural that this bill is a thrown together kind of dog's breakfast of a muddle. But Dan, two tactical questions to you. One, what do you make of the accusations from Republicans of dirty pool? You know, a bunch of them voted for this CHIPS bill on the assumption and apparently based on the assurance from Democrats that there wouldn't be a big reconciliation bill. And lo and behold, they get a big reconciliation bill after passing the CHIPS bill with a sizable bipartisan margin. This has led to a lot of recriminations, people saying that Mitch McConnell got played. So that's one tactical element of this. The other is there is this vet burn pit bill that Republicans opposed. And the claim from the left is Republicans voted this down sheerly out of partisan pique over getting played on the reconciliation bill. Whereas you have Pat Toomey and others saying, no, there's this provision in here that would make it much easier to spend several hundred billions of dollars on purposes totally unrelated to victims of burn pits or to even vet causes. What do you make of those two?
Yeah, I mean, I can't predict how things are going to go with Joe Manchin 2 years from now running on. I'm the same old Joe, but not the same as the other same old Joe. But as far as the strategy is concerned here, I can't imagine. Can you imagine Mitch McConnell doing what Schumer did with Sinema, which is you know, if you actually want to get a bill passed, negotiating it with only one of the two questionable votes nailed down, you know, I could see McConnell doing that if he wanted, if he knew that somebody in his caucus was going to go maverick and shoot it down, and it sort of needed to go down that way. But, you know, and then there's, I mean, I've seen some people.
So do you think it's kind of a foolish assumption that, from Schumer's purposes, you get the deal with Manchin, you celebrate it everywhere, you get all the press, oh, Biden's presidency is revived, and then you put all the pressure on Sinema and assume that she'll buckle?
Yeah, I think that's a bad assumption. I mean, maybe he knows more than we do behind the scenes. But, you know, when Mitch pulls things like this, I assume that he knows that. I don't have that assumption anymore with Schumer. I don't think most people do. And I do think that, look, you saw in the fall, you know, the Democrats, Schumer and Pelosi, basically lying to the House progressives to get them on board with, you know, detaching the infrastructure bill from Build Back Better. Oh, don't worry, you'll get Build Back Better. They didn't. And now, you know, Republicans were basically reassured on the CHIPS bill. Oh, don't worry, there's no kind of zombie Build Back Better coming. And it is. I don't think you spend your credibility with, I mean, yeah, politicians lie to the voters and all that all the time, but you don't lie to each other all that much. And if you do, you're really burning down credibility you're going to need in the future. Now, maybe Pelosi knows that she's never going to be speaker again after this at her age. I can't blame her. But you would think that Chuck Schumer has some ambitions beyond the end of this year, some hopes of retaining the Senate or of being around long enough for Democrats to take the Senate back. And I just think it's really foolish for them. And look, you know, if Republicans are now paranoid about this language in the vets bill because they think they're about to get a trap sprung on them, the fact that there was a trap just sprung on them, you know, it justifies that.
Mm-hmm. So, Jim, sidelight on this burn pit bill, John Stewart has been just a maniac about it. What do you think's become of John Stewart? Was he always such a kind of committed partisan and you know, just had the show where it was a little bit hidden under these layers of irony, or has something happened to him since, in your view?
Well, first of all, I think John Stewart probably has always been on the left of center. And those of us who are watching us for a long time wouldn't be surprised by this. I do think that John Stewart has tried to become a more responsible figure. A lot of folks on the rights complained about how Stewart had this shtick where he could do clown nose on, clown nose off. He would get praised by an institution like Rolling Stone, calling him the most important journalist in America, which was horse pucky. That's not, you know, but it's not the traditional definition of journalism. I don't think it's a really good definition of journalism. But what it is he made, particularly in the Bush years, was making a lot of jokes that folks on the left who worked in media liked. And he said the things they wished they could say on air. And I think that through Twitter and other forms of social media, we now know and we see them saying these sorts of things all the time. I take Stewart at his word. I think he genuinely has concerned about cares about 9/11 first responders. He's been active on this cause for a very long time. I think he bought into the hype that this was some sort of, you know, nefarious Republican plot to punish them and not an effort to kind of keep a clean bill, not full of extraneous stuff and you know, other shenanigans of managing to slip in much more controversial or less popular ideas amongst the kind of idea that every single person supports, which is take care of the 9/11 first responders. This, you know, Stewart, I think, has tried intermittently to, I think he's, you know, remember him denounced Tucker Carlson and was it Paul Begala? It was somebody on Crossfire where he basically told these guys, you're ruining America. And then I think he looks at what the Daily Show turned into and the degree to which, you know, late night humor became this industrial complex of leftist politics and not all that funny at all. Coupled with the, you know, woke censorship. And I think he's a little horrified at what folks who he used to think of as allies that also I'll always appreciate John Stewart for making the comparison that wondering where the Wuhan, where the virus in Wuhan could have come from and looking at the Wuhan Institute of Virology is like asking where the chocolatey goodness in Hershey, Pennsylvania came from. So I'll always have a soft spot for John Stewart because of that comparison that you could tell was making Stephen Colbert extremely uncomfortable.
you know, compared to the current media environment, the even the second iteration of Crossfire, which is kind of ruined by the presence of a studio audience, is still head and shoulders above above pretty much anything we see today. But that aside, Zan, exit question to you first. The Schumer Manchin deal will pass the Senate and the House and go to Joe Biden's desk for a signature, yes or no?
I think I'm going to go with no.
A bold no. Dan McLaughlin, yes or no?
I think it will. I'm not sure if it will, because Sinema is such a Sphinx-like figure. And there's also a risk that, you know, Republicans are going to sort of use this thing as a pinata once it hits the Senate floor. But I think everybody on the Democratic side is just too desperate for a win now, and they'll find a way to make it happen.
Jim Garrity.
I believe, and we talked about this Friday, my attitude was, yes, some version of this, probably a little bit tweaked, will pass. And I don't think it'll actually have a very big impact on the midterms or anything like that. But yeah, I think it'll end up on Biden's desk.
Yeah, I think it'll pass. There'll be some change that Sinema demands, and stripping out the carried interest or some other ask. But I have a hard time seeing Horatio at the bridge style bringing this thing down. The party is just too invested in it. And I think most of it, provisions are, you know, aren't things that are particularly hateful for her. So yes, it'll pass. It is relatively minor. It's a counterprotective, wasteful piece of legislation, but it's relatively minor compared to what we were talking about at the beginning of Build Back Better, and will do nothing, absolutely nothing, to help Democrats in the midterms. With that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor this episode, Tommy John Underwear. Is the summer heat melting your ice cubes? Stay frosty where it counts in brand new Tommy John underwear. Because when you wear Tommy John, you're that much cooler, so you can do everything better thanks to breathable, lightweight fabric with four times the stretch of competing brands. With dozens of comfort innovations, Tommy John will keep you looking and feeling cool all season long, from lounging at home to summertime fun. That's why Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have fanatics. With over 17 million pairs sold, people love their Tommy John underwear and loungewear. And Tommy John doesn't just make you feel cooler, you actually are cooler. Stay up to 7 degrees cooler than cotton and Tommy John's Apollo underwear. Plus, there's no risk because you're covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Shop TommyJohn.com/editors right now for 20% off your first order. Get 25% off right now at TommyJohn.com/editors. That's TommyJohn.com/editors. See the site for details. So, Dan, we've all been waiting in the Missouri gubernatorial race for an endorsement for Trump. He already basically tanked the woman in the race, whose name now escapes me, but she has fallen away. So Trump here we are Tuesday. The primary is the people are voting as we speak. We'll know the results presumably tonight. Trump has gone all in, Dan, for Eric, in a race between Eric Reitens and Eric Schmidt. You got that right. Trump is for Eric.
Yeah, this is just amazing, and it's an example of why Trump is so good at comedy, but also sort of not really fit for public office. It came down to for a while, it really was a three-horse race between Eric Reitens, the disgraced former governor of Missouri, and Eric Schmidt, the attorney general, and Vicky Hartzler, a congresswoman, and. You know, ultimately, Hartzler's support, and at least some of Brighton's, I think, have shifted towards Schmidt. I expect Schmidt to win. I'm not certain of that. But it seems that both sides were lobbying Trump for an endorsement, and he just totally went with the comedy route of saying it's Eric versus Eric. I'm endorsing Eric. The hilarious thing, of course, is that both of them immediately put out press releases saying, yeah. Thank you, President Trump, for your endorsement in this race. A word, by the way, I should, before we leave this race for the Senate, a word for Vicky Hartzler, right? Hartzler is she's not a superstar. If she was, she would not be running in third place. But she is a reliable, pro-life, conservative, experienced member of the House. And if you look at as a general election candidate and a prospective senator, it's kind of shocking that there aren't more candidates like her. She would be so much better than any of the Republicans who ran for the Senate in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Arizona, in Georgia. There are actually shockingly few House members, sort of solid, no real baggage, kind of generic R type House members who are running this year. I mean, you have Ted Budd in North Carolina. Mark Wayne Mullen is in the runoff for the Oklahoma special race. He may be the nominee. But there's actually not a lot of people moving up from the House. And there was a lot of attention paid to the failure to recruit governors to run. You know, Chris Sununu, Larry Hogan, Phil Scott, Doug Ducey, a lot of the governors begged out. But it's also kind of surprising that there's a lot of these races where you could have had some fairly experienced people in the House, who have been there, 5 to 10 years in the House, kind of not people who've been there forever, but are ready to seek a promotion and aren't doing that. So I think it is a shame that more of these Senate races that have kind of weak candidates that somebody from the House didn't step up.
Yeah. So Zan, tonight we got a pretty good batch of weak candidates. We got Eric Reitens in Missouri. Both his former mistress and his former wife betray him as a violent lout. Doesn't mean that everything they said about him is true, but there is a lot of smoke there. He's also kind of the worst sort of MAGA, stop the steal Republican. He did that infamous ad. We talked about it a month or two ago where he staged an armed home invasion of a rhino's house. And then we have Arizona that appears just to have completely gone out off the deep, and the leading gubernatorial candidate out there, this woman named Carrie Lake. She was a news anchor. When she still had her job, she was tweeting about Sidney Powell's accusations and how sobering they were. Then she quit to get into politics immediately. The worst sort of stop the steal ideologue, running on these conspiracy theories and lies and succeeding. You know, this is a state where the incumbent governor is Doug Ducey, arguably the best governed state in the country, right up there. And the Republican Party seems bent on immolating itself. And we'll see, maybe there's a surprise in that race. Her more rational opponent has been gaining, this woman Robeson has been gaining somewhat in the polls, but still seems like a long shot. So, but this Arizona might be the most depressing state in the union. I don't know, unless you want to put Pennsylvania up there.
Yeah, Pennsylvania too, I would definitely put in that category. It's very frustrating. I feel like we're kind of rewatching what happened with Trump all over again. Not that all these candidates are just like Trump, but what I mean is more Democrats are kind of putting the biggest, fattest softball over the plate that you could imagine. And Republicans are coming along with a wiffle bat, like a broken 2-year-old's wiffle ball bat. Like, it's just embarrassing, the people who are running. And I don't know enough about kind of why people decide to run or not, or who's supposed to be recruiting them and didn't, or sort of the mechanics of why it has shaken out this way. But it is disappointing to see that when Democrats are doing basically everything wrong, they're running as far to the left as possible. Republicans are responding by putting up people who are not running far to the right in a good way. They're not, solid conservatives as opposed to, squishy establishment Republicans. They're putting up a lot of crazy people who should not be in office, people who I wouldn't support if I lived in these states. And, hopefully in some of these cases, a better candidate can still win the primary. But maybe they won't. And the fact that there's a sizable number of people in these states that will vote for the crazy candidate is not a good sign of where the party's going. It's just very frustrating to watch when it seems like this should be a slam dunk year. And instead, we're just putting up, people just kind of like Trump, a horrible candidate we think we can get away with just because Democrats are so bad.
So, Jim, we see some of the effects already of poor candidate choice. Let's focus on two of them, the aforementioned Pennsylvania. There's a new poll out that has Fetterman, who's been off the campaign trail, recovering from a stroke with an enormous lead over Dr. Oz. Dr. Oz is almost nowhere to be seen. He's been very effectively mocked as a carpetbagger and a tourist in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Then you have Georgia, where Herschel Walker has not had great moments either. One of the phrases that sends chills down the spines of political consultants is secret children, you know, not just secret child, but secret children. Herschel Walker has had a number of them. He is not the most crisp communicator, not particularly well informed, but he's just narrowly behind Warnock, who has his own problems. And I'd also say we had this hideous MSNBC commentator referring to Herschel Walker as the N-word, not the worst N-word, but the other N-word. And Herschel put out a, you know, little 2-minute response. And the thing is, you know, it wasn't the greatest thing in the world, but there's a sincerity to it. You know, there's a genuine faith there. So I think Walker still has quite a good chance to win in Georgia. But Oz, ooh, it's looking grim.
Yeah, I was going to say, a couple of weeks ago, I referred to Oz as the Ford Pinto of Senate candidates for the Republicans this cycle. The slightest impact, and he seems to blow up. Not durable, not capable of taking any kind of a hit. This morning, the poll that was out has Fetterman at 52%. Oz at 38%. Now, maybe you can say, okay, this poll's really bad, but that's a 14-point spread. But we've had other ones that have had Fetterman up by 11 in Fox News and things like that. Not only has Oz not led any polls, he really hasn't been close. And this, you know, Leo, we all know that Oz won the GOP primary by the skin of his teeth. He was the one who was endorsed by Trump. There was great competition for that endorsement compared to Dave McCormick, whose wife had worked in his administration. A lot of folks saw McCormick as a safer bet. He would have been self-financing. Now, he ran a hedge fund. Could Fetterman have run a populist campaign against a guy who used to be CEO of one of the world's biggest hedge funds? Yeah. That, you know, I'm not saying McCormick would have been a slam dunk, but at minimum, McCormick probably would have made Democrats have to put an effort into this. Right now, with Oz down 14, it looks like this one is going to be looking pretty safe for the Democrats at this point. And this was not what it was supposed to be. Walker is helped out by the fact that, you know, Georgia is a more Republican, a redder state. Yes, it has two Democratic senators, but they won by the skin of their teeth in very unusual circumstances in that runoff. After Trump had been screaming that the election had been stolen, telling Georgians that their votes don't matter. You know, we all remember Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell and all that stuff. So, you know, Walker, I think when Walker gets attacked in vicious, defamatory and utterly unacceptable ways for being a Black Republican, I think it makes Republicans rally around him because people can recognize that that is utterly abhorrent and has no place in our politics. And I also wonder how much African Americans in Georgia look at that and appreciate, you know, of all the things you can criticize Herschel Walker for, you're going to criticize him for the color of his skin because he's a Republican? Is that really the card you want to play here? So I think Walker still has a chance. I you know, it's always feels silly to, well, people, a lot of people would say, oh, it's too early to write off Mehmet Oz, but God, there's just no sign of life out there. And, you know, the great irony, he's running against a guy who's practically in a coma. And it's now been like 3 months. It's not just been a little bit. That stroke hit Fetterman in mid-May. He's had the state to himself and he's lost ground, which is a real sign of a deeply troubled candidate who is a terrible mismatch for the state.
So, Zan, there is an important matter on the ballot tonight that does not involve candidates one way or the other. It's this proposed constitutional amendment in Kansas on abortion. What are the stakes here? What's your quick forecast?
Yeah, so what's going on is of course, the first big vote on abortion since Dobbs came down and Roe was overturned. And Kansas is one of just a handful of states in the country that has a state Supreme Court decision, essentially, you know, a kind of state version of Roe. So a decision claiming that there's somehow a right to abortion in the Kansas Constitution. And so a couple of years back, there's this initiative to get a ballot amendment to the state constitution saying that the Kansas Constitution does not protect abortion, essentially reversing that state Supreme Court ruling via a ballot measure. So that'll be on the ballot tonight. And, you know, there hasn't been much good polling on how it's going to go. I think overall, Kansas is a more pro-life state than not. But the strategy from the other side has been to claim essentially that if the ballot amendment passes, it's going to be a total abortion ban across the entire state, which is not true. It just kind of sets a neutral slate so lawmakers can actually legislate on abortion. So we will have to wait and see how that goes.
So, exit question to you, Jim Garrity. At the moment, your guess is Republicans will win the Senate or blow the Senate?
I'm really worried that they will blow the Senate, but right now, I guess maybe I could see them having a 51-49 split in their favor.
Dan McLaughlin.
I think that's probably about where I am now. I think they're going to blow some seats that they should win. But I think there's enough opportunities on the board that they're probably going to end up, you know, they're going to end up winning it, but not nearly as many opportunities as they could have had.
Zan.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's just too, the climate is too bad for Democrats to think that Republicans will blow it that badly. But I think they'll give up a number of seats that just basic, normal, run-of-the-mill Republican would have won easily.
So I'm going to make it unanimous, so it must be wrong, but I'm going to go exactly the same place and leave money on the table with some of these poor candidate choices, but the environment and the map is just enough to get them over the top and take control of the Senate. With that, let's hear from our final sponsor of this episode, Acton Unwind. Inflation, spiking gas prices and supply chain disruptions, woke celebs and corporations, political cronies and big tech polarization, and a culture in crisis. We know it's hard to stay up to speed with everything that's happening in the world. That's where Acton Unwind comes in. Join experts from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty every Monday as they dissect the latest headlines in an easy-to-unravel roundtable conversation. Chat about politics, religion, and culture through Acton Institute's unique perspective, connecting good intentions with sound economics to promote a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by principles. To subscribe to Acton Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or just search Acton Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcast. That's acton.org/NR. One more time, acton.org/NR to subscribe. And my apologies to our listeners. Sarah, you can lead this in. Gotta open another Coke. It's a two Coke podcast. So Jim, when we were discussing prior to recording, whether we talk about Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan, the killing of Zawahiri, maybe some of the tension now between the Biden administration and Zelensky. I was like, what should we do, guys? You, with your great experience as a commentator, is like, we put it all in one bucket, Rich, under world affairs. So that was a genius insight, Jim. And I'm going to you first in the world affairs segment. Let's talk about that Pelosi trip. A lot of static around it. You had people in the Biden administration saying she shouldn't do this. You had a lot of saber rattling from the CCP. She goes anyway and is in Taiwan, I believe. As we speak, the Chinese have buzzed Taiwanese airspace, kind of intimidation tactics you would expect. What do you make of it?
First of all, Rich, I believe that world affairs was Bill Clinton's second favorite Jeopardy category after domestic affairs. So yeah, Pelosi is in Taiwan. Her plane was not shot down on the way in. There was no attempts to buzz it or intimidate it. There was apparently a significant cyber attack against some Taiwanese government computers. And there was the usual flyover and violation of their airspace and things like that. I hate to say it, that's almost becoming like, you know, part of the weather over there in Taiwan. Look, the world has not ended. This has been the first visit for a House Speaker to Taiwan since Newt Gingrich back in 1997, I believe. Look, and she is saying all of the right things. We were talking about this on Friday's podcast and just say, you know, we're not usually in the business of saying, good job, Nancy Pelosi. But this is exactly the sort of thing that the House Speaker, and you'd like to see a broad bipartisan agreement that we stand by Taiwan and will not, you know, accept China's bullying or anything like that. I had said that the moment China said, no, she can't go there, she has to go, that there was no way. Otherwise, you're giving China a veto over what U.S. officials do and where they go and things like that. So that much has been done. I do not buy into this. Like, is it going to upset China? Sure. Is China going to, you know, figure out some ways to mess with us in response? Yes. Is this, did this make the whole trip not worthwhile? No, I think this is important. You could argue about whether this actually had to happen. I think this is occurring because Pelosi knows she's not likely to be speaker after January. And this was her last chance to do something like this. Look, I think the world will keep turning after this. I don't think this will lead to a war. Is China's aggression towards Taiwan something to keep an eye on and be very worried about? Yes. But I don't think that this was likely to be the trigger. Now, I suppose there's always a possibility that they harass her plane on the way out or something like that. But I think this is All in all, been a pretty good week for America between Pelosi's visit and Zawahiri assuming room temperature.
Yeah. So, Zan, I'm where Jim is on this. You know, if there had been some quiet back channeling when this trip was in the planning stages and, you know, folks in the Biden administration said, you know, Mrs. Speaker, why don't we just skip this one? All right, maybe do that. But once you're going, you can't allow the Chinese to intimidate you out of it and create an entirely new red line over Taiwan. You know, House speakers, as Jim alluded to, have gone before. So I'm not in favor of taking needless risks or being needlessly provocative. We got a lot on our plate, obviously, with the conflict in Ukraine, but I agree that this was the right thing to do.
I think so too. And as Jim points out, it's been a long time and there's been a lot, you know, a lot has changed between China and Taiwan since then. Well, not fundamentally, nothing has changed, but we've seen a lot of action that suggests that we aren't going to have to think seriously about whether or not to become involved at some point. We don't know what's going to happen. It's become even more uncertain, I think. And so that being said, I think it makes sense to demonstrate support. And that doesn't need to look like, you know, coming out and saying we're going to defend Taiwan no matter what. That obviously would not be a smart diplomatic move. But I think it's kind of a soft way of saying, look, we know Taiwan's here. We basically recognize them. We're going to visit if we want to. Our government supports them. And certainly we're not going to listen to China if they say we can't. I agree with you. I think that's the red line where you have to go anyway. Even if it wasn't really necessary to go in the first place, you can't give them dictatorship power over where our politicians go or don't go.
So Dan, on Zawahiri, man, this has been a long time coming, but it's heartening and underlining that we never forget and we're never going to let you go. And no matter how long it takes, no matter where you are, we're going to hunt you down. So congratulations to everyone involved, including President Biden authorizing this strike. But you know, Zawahiri apparently was in downtown Kabul, which is entirely a product of our withdrawal from Afghanistan. Now, on the other hand, apparently we're still able to get intelligence and to act on it quickly enough, even when we're not there on the ground, to have got this done. But it's not a great statement about our Afghan withdrawal.
No, I mean, at the same time, you know, look, the intelligence that we get depends on, you know, a variety of situations. I mean, look, you know, we got bin Laden in large part because we caught his courier crossing the border in Iraq. So, you know, having boots on the ground there turned out to be absolutely decisive to getting bin Laden. But I mean, it is certainly good news that, you know, whether it's bin Laden, Zawahiri, Zarqawi, Saddam, Soleimani, al-Baghdadi, al-Rimi, there's a lot of these guys, and sooner or later we get them. And it, you know, the work has continued across administrations, and we don't have the full story yet. Of course, we'll never have the full story of how they got Zawahiri, but, you know, it is encouraging to see that they were still able to track him down in there. Yeah, I very much doubt he would have been walking around the Capitol when we still had boots on the ground there.
So Jim Garrity, asks a question to you, going back to Taiwan, not right now, you know, not in the next week, month, this year, but eventually we will fight a war with China over the status of Taiwan, in your view, yes or no?
Yes, and it will be short. I just don't know which side's going to win.
Zan?
I'll go with yes, given the long view nature of the question.
Dan?
I am increasingly worried that we're going to see something like this, not only in the long view, but in the short view, in the window of opportunity that Xi Jinping has to do something while Joe Biden is in office. But at the end of the day, much as is true of Putin, this is a decision that will be made inside of one head.
Yeah. So I take your point, Dan. Bridge Colby, the foreign policy thinker, he co-wrote a cover story, a debate over whether we should fight over Taiwan last year with a guy named Patrick Porter. He's been warning that he thinks China could go much sooner than we expect. I'm going to say no, because I think either China is going to take an anaconda kind of gray zone approach where they don't directly assault the island. They just sort of squeeze it. Or even if China does go directly after it, I'm going to say we don't defend it. So I'm a no with that. Let me do a quick NR Plus plug. NR Plus, of course, the digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. And I'll make it really brief. This is a hugely important way for you to support our journalism. You can support our journalism in a couple ways. You can donate. Fantastic. We love it. Or you can sign up for NR Plus. You sign up for NR Plus, all sorts of other benefits, no more meter paywall, 90% fewer ads. You can comment if you want to. But the main thing is this is a way to help us keep doing what we're doing. We love doing it. Most of us would do it for free, but we can't. We have all sorts of bills to pay. And the way best way for you to help us in that regard is just to give in and sign up for NR Plus. So let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim, you had yet another encounter with wild ponies in Assateague, this time a bit of a threatening one.
Yeah, so the horses at Assateague are indeed wild. I guess apparently the story goes that there was no charge for having them graze on the island, and they just ended up staying there, and they've had, you know, baby horses, and they've been there for many, many years, you know, going back generations. And they tell you, stay away 40 feet from them. And the first time we visited, we could see them from the road, and they were, you know, off in the distance, and everything was fine. But there are all kinds of signs warning you that these are wild horses. Do not touch them. Do not pet them. They are not friendly. They bite, they kick, they can trample you. Well, this time, my older son is off to space camp. We're doing another, you know, beach weekend, and we're in the parking lot. And I thought I heard my son being a little exasperated, going, pfft. No, it was not him going, pfft. It was a horse going, pfft. And there were a good five or six horses in the parking lot. And needless to say, it's a little bit tougher to stay 40 feet away. Apparently lots of people leave food in the parking lot. If you happen to go to Assateague, don't do this because this will attract the horses. And there's always a, you know, minor risk to life and limb. We managed to get away, keep our distance as we're supposed to, but there were a bunch of, let's say, non-Mensa candidate tourists who were getting way too close to them. Thankfully, no one was hurt. They're wonderful. They're a lot of fun to take pictures of, but as usual, keep your distance, folks.
So, Dan, you saw the movie Everything Everywhere at Once.
Yes, very highly touted movie. Lots of people I trusted told me that it was going to be great. I was looking forward to it with great anticipation. It was terrible. And I know that that's a divisive opinion, but at least you should consider this a warning to look up more about what the movie is about before you see it. It was weird. There was a whole lot of multiverse stuff that I didn't quite know going in was exactly the plot structure. There was too much. It was too long. There was too much bizarreness. You know, there's a nice human story at the center of this movie. The performances were good. But I would not recommend it. And it was, if you don't like things that are very surreal and often pointlessly so, thumbs down.
So, Zan, I saved you for last. We got to have the best for last. You have a garden update for us.
Well, this is really embarrassing now because I'm following two much more exciting items. But I do have a garden update. I remember earlier in the spring, I had talked a little bit about what I was setting up. And our tomato plant actually has been thriving. We've harvested 3 or 4 tomatoes, which is not much really. But compared to last year, it took months and months to get even one actual well-formed tomato that wasn't eaten by a squirrel or a bird. So we're doing a lot better than last year, which is the mark of good gardening. Plus, I have a full herb garden, which pretty much every time I cook now or we make drinks or whatever for friends, I can just go out there and cut some basil, cut some mint, cut some chives, which is awesome. There's just nothing really like using your own homegrown herbs for your cooking.
So I made a disastrous mistake yesterday and showed up for a train at Union Station in Washington, D.C., more than an hour early. I just had the time wrong. I pride myself on cutting trains close. Jack Fowler, Jack, if you're listening, how's it going? I had this debate about how early you should show up for a plane. Jack has to show up like for a flight, you know, 3.5 hours early. I don't cut flights close. because there are too many variables. You know, the security line, you never know how long it's going to be. And it's more consequential usually to miss a flight than a train. But if I show up, you know, more than 10 minutes before a train is scheduled to depart, I'm questioning my choices. And oftentimes I've had to run. So the last 15 years, I've taken a lot of trains. I maybe missed three but have not wasted a lot of time sitting around the station. But I made a mistake. I was in Union Station. Union Station is now a wasteland. It's kind of depressing. The Starbucks that had kind of two locations in there is gone. There was a big center restaurant right in the middle of the huge station, gone. And it seems like just everyone wants to move out, so there are fewer places for homeless people to sit around and harass people, which is kind of sad. But anyway. That was my poor time management, showing up so early for a train. With that, it's time for editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, as usual, a lot of strong options, but Jimmy Quinn has just been all over the story of Pelosi traveling to Taiwan. He's now written several articles and corner posts about it. Most recently, shortly before we started taping, why Pelosi did it, in her own words. But if you want to know basically the breadth and depth of everything relating to this decision by Pelosi to travel there and the consequences, read Jimmy Quinn. He was on the podcast last week, and he's a terrific young man.
Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece from yesterday by John McCormick. It's called American Abortion Laws Do Not Require Delaying Treatment for a Mother's Life-Threatening Condition. And John goes through, there's been kind of a long debate over the last month or so, abortion supporters claiming that pro-life laws threaten mothers' lives and that they're not written clearly enough. And I've written about this quite a bit at NR, and John does some follow-up reporting that's very useful, clarifying what exactly is in these laws and why it protects both mothers and children.
Dan, what's your pick?
I'm going to go with Isaac Shore's piece yesterday. Biden administration declares open season on religious hospitals that object to gender transitions. I think it's another, important bit of coverage of, this kind of culture war, where I think the administration is deliberately picking a fight with religious hospitals, rather than try to work with them.
So my pick is by my friend, the great navalist Jerry Hendricks. It's a magazine piece, The Navy's Littoral Hubris, about the disastrous wrong turn the Navy made in making a major investment in these littoral combat ships, why it was a mistake, what played into it. It's another fantastic piece of work by Jerry. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. A rebroadcast, retransmission, or count this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thanks to my very able guest host, Jim Garrity, who filled in twice last week, in all seriousness. Thanks so much, Jim, and great work. Thanks to Zan. Thanks to Dan. Thanks to NetChoice, Tommy John, and Acton Unwind. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.